My guest Clinton Lacey works with young people who have just gotten out of Rikers Island, trying to help them break the cycle of crime and incarceration. Lacey is the Assistant Executive Director of Friends of the Island Academy. It was founded by the first principal of the Rikers Island High School and provides transitional support for young people who have just been released from jail. Lacey has worked with the program since 1992. I asked him where he begins with a young person who has just entered the program.
We begin to have a conversation with them about, yes, looking at their communities, looking at the pathology, you know, the long list of ills that they face in their communities, that their families face, and actually acknowledge that that's where most of them are going to return. So then, and we also will spend some time talking about putting that in some kind of historical context, trying to find some cause for that. But at the end of the day, once that understanding is achieved, you know, we still needed to do something to empower them to survive it, to somehow negotiate through that. And so that really points to them changing themselves, changing the way they view themselves. So instead of becoming victimized, or instead of being part of the problem, instead of cooperating in the cycle of incarceration and the cycle of substance abuse and what have you, that they could begin to make alternative choices, begin to make different decisions.
One of the things that Andre said in the interview was that it was really exciting when he first got a gun, and it got him respect. Do you have to work a lot with young people when they get out of jail in Rikers Island to help them find other ways that they can get respect without carrying a gun?
Yes, that's one of the most important issues for them and for us, this concept of respect. And so we do something when we go out to Rikers and other places. There's an exercise called Two Sides of the Street. And what we do is we basically ask the young people to help us describe one side of the street, the side that they're really quite experts in, and they can talk about what is respect on the side of the street where there's violence and drugs and what have you. And not just describing what respect is, but describing what success is. And so we start listing issues on that side of the street, such as carrying weapons, selling drugs. You know, how do you resolve conflicts on that side of the street? You know, 9 times out of 10 violently. What takes place on that side of the street? What are relationships characterized by? You know, lack of trust and always looking over your shoulder for danger, running from the police, the threat of death and violence and incarceration. And then what we begin to do is, and after we've really exhausted that list and listened to them, we begin to construct another side of the street and describe what's over there. So while on one side of the street there's fast money, quick money, illegal money, we describe on the other side of the street what we call steady flow, or the idea of getting paid every 2 weeks, and to discussing what is credit and what is financing. And so we start to transition from what exists on one side of the street and start to show what can exist on the other. So in terms of respect, on one side you need to carry a weapon or you need to have people fear you. But on the other side of the street, respect is really based on something else like admiration and love and camaraderie. And so we begin to help them make that transition.
Now, Andre was telling us that the first time he got out of Rikers Island, he got a job in a shopping mall in a store, and he started forging credit cards. He stole credit card numbers from customers and then managed to forge cards.
Right.
He went back to prison for that, and it was only subsequent to that that he decided to seriously go straight. I imagine that happens with a lot of people who ultimately succeed, that it takes a while. Just like mm-hmm. stopping smoking takes a while to really give it up. But so I'm wondering, when you try to help people who've gotten out of jail, help them land a job, what do you tell potential employers? Because they would have every right to be worried that there might be some slip-ups.
Yeah, if I could just back up one moment, and before, which to the first part of your question was just about that issue of it took like an intervention like jail, you know, for people to, you know, finally wake up or finally make some changes. It's something that a story that we use a lot in our work is the story of Malcolm X and how it was in jail that he began to transform himself, and he read the dictionary and began to educate himself. And he said that if he hadn't have been arrested, he was surely headed to get himself killed in the street. And a lot of the young people talk about that, that they were on a path. And not to say that it's a good thing that they were arrested, but it also speaks to the lack of other interventions that are out there to prevent them in the first place. So yes, for a lot of them, it was after their first, second, or third incarceration that they finally say, okay, something has to change. But then back to where that question led in terms of employment, it's a struggle. I mean, there are certain employers who, as soon as it is shared or revealed that the person has a criminal background and particularly a felony, then it's just a closed door. What we've done is spend a lot of time going out, hitting the pavement, forming relationships with employers, talking to them, trying to build the relationship where they would give young people a chance, and also guaranteeing them that they've gone through a pretty extensive workshop where they, you know, have everything from interviewing skills to, you know, punctuality and working with others. Most recently, we're getting ready to begin to get our young people bonded, which is a great incentive for employers in terms of worrying about theft and things like that.
What do you do when you and the people you work with have mm-hmm. worked very hard to get one of the young people placed in a job? And this, we're talking about a young person who's recently out of jail. You get them the job, and they screw up. They steal, or they stop showing up. And I'm sure you feel very responsible to the employer because you've maybe given your word that you work closely with the person, you have faith in them, and they've let you down. How do you deal with them afterwards?
Well, it's something that we've had to deal with a lot. More than stealing as such, much more prevalent has been just the leaving the job, you know, lack of retention, that mm-hmm. they've either, you know, being late or not showing up or dealing with conflicts on the job, taking directions from supervisors. And so, yeah, it really is a struggle to work with the young people and also to maintain an open door and an opportunity to place more people on certain jobs. When they do fall down on the path, when they do lose jobs, it's not the end of the road for them. You know, we help pick them back up, dust them off, and get back at it again.
When you do pick them up after mm-hmm. somebody has let you down, mm-hmm. what's your attitude in terms of being very understanding or being very tough about not allowing that to happen again?
Well, the toughness is in the standards. Okay, so we set high standards for them. And so the toughness is in the consistency and the clarity of what's expected. But the love and the compassion is in that we keep coming back to the table. It's like, okay, look, this is where you made a mistake. Now this is what you have to do. And so you have another chance. For us to, you know, close the door on somebody, for us to say, all right, that's it, this is it, we're not working with you anymore, which has only happened in really a couple of extreme cases, means that we were the last stop for them. You know, the youth that come to our program, most of them, they're not accepted back into their high schools. They're not accepted back into other institutions that they may have been affiliated with, if they were indeed aligned with any other institutions. And so that we become not just the program, but we become, in many senses, the community. And sometimes the family. And so it's the kind of attitude that a family, you could imagine that a family would have with their child or with one of their loved ones who continues to fall on the path, continues to get in trouble. They continue to try to work and find solutions to those issues.
You're working with young people who are from poor backgrounds, who come from violent neighborhoods. Are you from a neighborhood like that yourself, or are you from a different kind of background and had to, in a way, learn the language that the young people you work with speak?
Right. I was very fortunate to have had, you know, both parents in my home growing up, and I am the son of two educators, and so they were able to provide for us both a relatively comfortable, material existence, certainly, nowhere near wealthy or anything like that, but, comfortable, not worrying about when we were going to eat or getting clothing, and certainly not living under the constant threat of violence and what have you that characterizes the young folks that we're talking about now and the communities that they come from. So, no, I didn't grow up in a community like that. I didn't grow up having to face the things that they faced. I was able to have a childhood, unlike these young folks. So, that, though, as far as I'm concerned, I've never seen that as a barrier to working with young people. The language, the culture is not something alien to me, because the experience of black folks in this country, the experience of black and Latino folks, I think is somewhat of a family affair, and so, I didn't really, there was not really slang that was alien to me, and there certainly was a cultural gap. Certainly the first day walking into Rikers Island, for me back in 1992, I didn't know what to expect, and I knew that, no, I had never spent time at Rikers Island, and so, I certainly was questioning my ability to do this work. So I've always set limits. I've always, I think, received respect, and I've rarely ever been accused of being soft or not knowing what's happening or anything like that, because that's just a perception of some people who haven't seen other types of people, So if all they've seen is television, or if all they know is what they've heard about people who aren't from the hood, right, or whatever, then there's perceptions the same way people outside of the hood have a whole set of perceptions about people in it. So I think it's through the experience of actually working with people, interacting with people, where they say, hey, there's different types of people out here. There's something called balance, and so you don't have to be a sellout. The two extremes, it's not either being a sellout or being a thug, right? A so-called thug or a so-called sellout. There's something in between those extremes that's a healthy way to be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Clinton Lacey is the Assistant Executive Director of the Friends of the Island Academy, which provides transitional support for young people who have just been released from Rikers Island. This is Fresh Air.